Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Hey guys, thanks so much for tuning in to the first Zonal Marking podcast of 2021. This pod is brought to you by The Athletic, and it's a new year, but very much the same us. And by us, I mean myself, Ali Maxwell, and with me, Michael Cox from The Athletic, and also Tom Warville. Happy New Year to you, Tom. How's it going? All well?
Thanks, Ali. Happy New Year to you too. Yes, all good, thank you. A nice extended break. I realised I think I worked 3 days in December, which was fantastic for my mental health. feeling fully refreshed, recharged and ready to go for 2021.
Just to tick the start of pod small talk box and a topical one, I was going to ask you if you've got any New Year's resolutions for 2021, but in thinking about it, I realise you probably call them life's marginal gains.
Oh, wow, that's really quite depressing. I had a couple of New Year's resolutions. First is trying to get up earlier in the day, which is so far going well. And the other is going to the gym more. But given recent news, that one is, it's proving difficult to do at the moment. But so far, so good.
Where there's a will, there's a way. Michael, how are you doing? Happy New Year to you.
I'm very well, thank you. Happy New Year. And Happy New Year to all the listeners as well.
Very Happy New Year to the listeners. I'm sad you got to say that before I did. Are you heading into 2021 with any tactical tweaks in Michael Cox's life?
No. No, pretty much the same. We do have a new analytics writer on board who Tom can probably tell the listeners more about. But yeah, quite exciting and probably more kind of graphs and more stats and more figures. And if you like that kind of thing, which you hopefully do if you're listening to this podcast, then there should be more of that on the site.
The Marcelo Bielsa approach, no compromise whatsoever. I wouldn't have expected anything different. Tom, a new analyst on The Athletic, not a rival of yours, but a co-worker. That's exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. We've recently signed Mark Carey, who has done some public work with in kind of the analytics space before, and he's recently finished a project with a championship club looking at how they can translate performances and stats from other leagues to understand whether a player would perform just as well in the championship, which I think was really exciting. So look forward to getting Mark on board and set up. He will be picking up some of the kind of more ad hoc requests and then in time kind of adding his own work to the site, which in turn kind of frees me up to do more bigger projects like the one we're chatting about today.
Oh, go on then, Coxie. What are we chatting about today?
We're chatting about Frank Lampard and we're chatting about Chelsea. And yeah, after the recent poor run of results, there's been a lot of speculation about Lampard's job and maybe about what his goal is as a manager, or at least as a manager at Chelsea. And me and Tom have been digging into the numbers and I've been kind of looking at some of the past performances, particularly in the big games this season. And we've come to some conclusions in an article that's out today on the website. And thought we'd make a good podcast from it as well.
yeah, in conjunction with a Warville and Cox special on the Athletic site about this very topic. But it would be remiss not to mention the brilliant Chelsea coverage on there as well, and coverage of all Premier League sides, of course. Simon Johnson and Liam Toomey do a wonderful job. In fact, it was mere moments after the final whistle on Sunday, after that 3-1 defeat to Manchester City, that their piece went live, suggesting that Chelsea have begun to explore alternative plans with a view to replacing Lampard if the current slump continues, if not sooner. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And just a reminder to anyone listening that now is as good a time as ever to sign up to The Athletic and become an annual subscriber. TheAthletic.com/zonalmarking will see you get an annual subscription and you'll pay just £3.99 a month. So if you want to read everything that Michael and Tom churn out, the new analyst Mark and many others, then please do join today. And now let's get into Chelsea. We're going to try and dissect as well as we can, and in the only way that we know, performances and results, tactics, of course, the underlying data, any issues with individual players, what's gone well, of course, and whether the guys think that Lampard can ride this out. This being a run of 4 defeats in 7 matches. They've dropped down to 9th in the table. This run was preceded by a 17-game unbeaten run across all competitions. So let's start with these 2 runs. Michael, what's been going wrong for Chelsea in this recent poor run of form?
I'd say more than anything else, they've been let down in the 2 penalty boxes, and in terms of the finishing at one end and the goalkeeping at the other end. We know that they haven't really had a consistent centre forward. They've used Abraham, they've used Giroud, they've used Werner in the centre forward position. All of them have done some good things at some stages, but they don't really have a cohesive plan in the final third. I'd also point to the fact that Timo Werner, I think we all know he's struggling for goals. There's been some decent analysis of him and his finishing by Alan Shearer on the Athletic website. But I mean, the stat that I think says more than anything is the fact he's hit the woodwork 5 times this season, which is more than anyone else in the Premier League. So I just think the finishing is letting Chelsea down. At the other end, I think it's fair to say that Mendy has been an upgrade on Kepa. I don't think it's harsh to say he probably couldn't have got much worse than Kepa's performance last season. But his really good run in the first few weeks has slightly slipped back. And Tom came up with some very good numbers to show that while for the first 7 or 8 Premier League games, he was basically saving more shots than you'd expect, you know, when you account for the positions of the shots and where they were directed. But in the last few weeks, he slipped behind it. And he's made a couple of mistakes. I think the mistake for the Bamford goal at Stamford Bridge in a game Chelsea eventually won against Leeds was notable. It just looked like he was uncomfortable sweeping. It was a poor decision. And there was also the concession of the penalty when he brought down Dominic Calvert-Lewin, again when sweeping, quite a poor mistake, I thought. And that allowed Sigurdsson to score from the penalty spot. So, yeah, I think there's some issues, obviously, in the vast expanse of pitch between the boxes, which we'll come on to talk about, I'm sure. But I think, I mean, if Chelsea's goalkeeping and finishing had been at, you know, inverted commas, normal levels, I think Chelsea would be in the top 4 and we probably wouldn't be doing this podcast.
Tom, we're going to talk more generally about the season as a whole, the underlying numbers, but currently we're discussing this recent poor run of form. Does what Michael says get backed up when you look at the numbers? Any key drop-offs, any hints as to what's been going wrong?
So Chelsea at one end of kind of, they've scored more than expected actually. They've basically had 1.4 XG4 per game and they've scored nearly, you know, 1.7 goals per game. So that's a pretty big jump. And you know, some players, I think Tammy Abraham specifically has finished pretty well so far this season, but then you've got Werner who actually is undershot his expected goals. And at the other end, Chelsea have got really, really solid defensive numbers in terms of expected goals against. Just sorting the table by that, they've got the 4th highest behind Liverpool, Brighton of all teams, and Manchester City. They've conceded a little bit more than expected, so you'd think that overall in the long run, those two numbers would kind of come in line together by the end of the season, and Chelsea near enough are probably the 4th best team in the league so far this season. So I do think that the recent kind of dry spell and getting 4 points in 6 games, so out of a possible 18, isn't great, obviously, for any team that's challenging for the top 4 or the title in a season as close as this one. But it does feel that there's just been a bit of misfortune and the underlying levels aren't too bad and definitely better than probably expectation and the narrative currently suggests they are.
Okay, well, I mean, quite a positive start, I would say. More so than I was expecting anyway. General narrative surrounding Chelsea in the last few days has been very negative, as you'd expect, as is always the case with the customary Premier League side in crisis at any given time. But, Michael, in the last eight, they've played five of the teams above them and they've not beaten any of them. In fact, if you stretch it over the course of the season, they're in ninth. They've played seven of the eight teams above them in the league, Chelsea, and they haven't won in any of those games. Is there one clear reason for you why that has been the case?
Yeah, I mean, this then becomes a discussion more about what they're doing in midfield, I'd say. I think the poor finishing and poor goalkeeping has probably cost them in a few games that they've drawn against weaker sides. In the games against bigger sides, and in particular I'm thinking about 2-0 loss to Liverpool earlier in the season, the 3-1 defeat to Manchester City the weekend, and also the 3-1 against Arsenal, who I know, looking at the table, are not a big club, but that still feels like a big game to me. I think their pressing in midfield has been quite poor, and when I look at the shape of Chelsea, it's like Lampard very much wants Chelsea to press, but the actual organisation, the actual details, the actual specifics behind that don't seem to be there. And quite often, I think Chelsea are just quite easy to pass through. I think sometimes the defensive midfield is too high and leaves too much space behind. Sometimes the three in midfield seem to be doing almost the same job and end up in the same zones. And sometimes there's just there's just an uncoordinated nature to the midfield. Sometimes one of the midfielders is really high, the other two are deep, or two really high, one is deep. And they're just quite easy to play through. I don't think that's been an issue in some of the other big games. In some of the other smaller games, because I think the defence is quite well organised. You know, I think Thiago Silva has generally been very good. I'd actually say much better than I expected. I thought he might struggle a bit in terms of pace, but he's been really good. But I think sometimes against the really big sides, you know, that hasn't been enough to prevent them being opened up. So yeah, I would say without the ball, and particularly how they're trying to win it back, that's the area for me that Lampard has to take full responsibility for and can't really blame his players for underperforming. That's just an organisational issue. And I think that has cost them in the big games.
And Tom, I mean, against the teams below them, they've often scored a fair few goals. Three against Brighton, four against Palace, three against Burnley, four against Sheffield United, three against Leeds and West Ham as well. But in those bigger games against the teams above them, they're just not doing it offensively at all.
No, I mean, if you look at the XG and the quality chances they produce in games against Everton, Tottenham and Man United, they are some of the lowest that they've produced in kind of any game this season. And those games against Spurs and Man U specifically are in kind of the bottom 10 games in the Premier League this season in terms of total XG in the fixture, which says that just those are just really dull, drab, kind of slow, boring affairs. And I think that plays into some kind of risk-averse nature that Lampard seemingly has against bigger sides. There's just an inability to either create chances or take risks, which just makes them kind of quite dull games. Now, the Everton game, I think that Chelsea had 71% possession in the end, which obviously is a really high number and to some extent shows the impact of Everton kind of shelling. They sat back after Gylfi Sigurdsson scored his penalty and didn't really look to threaten afterwards. And then again, it's another example really of this season of a team who, kind of like we saw with Liverpool against Southampton, not really having a solid plan to try and break through a low block, a deep block, and actually try and create good quality chances.
As soon as you said risk averse there, the image of that first half against Tottenham, the 0-0 game that you referenced there, where Spurs, if you remember, had just come off the back of beating, I think it was Manchester City, with the first goal having been in transition and Kane and Son involved. And you could just see that no one in Chelsea Blue wanted to be the one to give it away in Tottenham's half and be the one to be at fault essentially for a period of transition that Spurs scored from. And in the end, we had, as you mentioned there, one of the most drab games that we've seen this season. More positive times. I mean, I mentioned before this run, it was 17 unbeaten in all competitions. I believe it was 9 in the league, of which 5 were wins and 4 were draws. Michael, looking back at that time and comparing it to this poorer run, what stands out? What was going well there that hasn't been going well recently?
Well, the back four was solid, I think, by and large, as I said before. I think they were getting lots of goals from defenders and from set pieces, particularly Kurt Zouma, but Chilwell, I think, as well, was popping up with a goal-scoring threat. Reece James as well, with a goal at Brighton. And I think they were very good down the right, particularly when Ziyech and Reece James have combined. I think they have a really good relationship. That said, it was an easy run of games. I mean, I remember doing a podcast at that time and having to, you know, talk about why Chelsea were playing well. And it really just seemed like December was going to be a much bigger test for them because of the difficulty of fixtures. And as I say, I think against stronger opposition, the organisational problems in the midfield have become more obvious.
Yeah, this midfield, already mentioned a few times, hinted at already in the early parts of the pod. Let's tackle it head on now, followed by other various bits of this Chelsea side. I mean, midfield balance, in terms of what Chelsea are achieving or not here, a lot seems to come back to N'Golo Kante and Jorginho and how to fit them together, how to get the best out of them, how to fit them into a well-balanced midfield. And Michael, what's ridiculous is that I feel like this has been part of the Chelsea conversation for about 2.5-3 years now. Where do you fall in this Kante, Jorginho, who should play where debate?
Yeah, you're right. It's the third season, isn't it? One of Sarri and now two of Lampard. I mean, I must say, I think Kante has been quite poor in recent weeks, particularly in those big games against Arsenal, Manchester City. I think he's been quite clumsy with the way that he receives the ball, quite slow on the turn, often just has basically played passes straight to opponents. He's still a pretty good ball winner when you look at the stats, but I think he has been caught out of position more. I think he's conceding quite a lot of fouls, one of which was crucial in the loss to Arsenal because Granit Xhaka slammed the free kick into the top corner. I do prefer Jorginho there, albeit I do really like Jorginho from his Napoli days, and I think it's fair to say he's never quite got to that level at Chelsea. I think it's interesting that for the final half hour against Manchester City, when the game was probably dead, Lampard threw on Billy Gilmore, who I would say is, broadly speaking, a Jorginho-type player. He's got the same kind of build. He's got a good passing range. He's much more a technical player than he is a ball winner like Kante. And I do wonder whether that could be an option in upcoming weeks at the base of midfield.
I think it's interesting that for other teams that seem to play with a 4-3-3 and have that kind of three or that trio of central midfielders, you usually have like City with Rodri and Liverpool with Fabinho, usually if he's fit, they usually definitely just have one sitting player, like the Jorginho role, who isn't the most agile or able to move around the pitch, but they either excel in breaking up play or being able to progress the ball forwards. I mean, I did a piece not so long ago now about Rodri, indirectly about Rodri really, and his quality both under pressure and ability to break lines. And it feels like it for, you know, for Lampard, if you're having the base of your trio as someone who's a bit of an energetic, I was going to say headless chicken, but it is definitely, there's just a good level of energy that Kante brings. You probably have to balance that out with the other two being a bit more, you know, hoping to, or being okay with kind of sitting and not really doing as much work. And with Mount on one side, who again is super energetic, really aggressive, happy to kind of push forward and press. And Kovacic on the other side, whose main strength really is carrying the ball and therefore doesn't really offer a level of protection because he's, you know, the value you get from him, having him there, is him venturing upfield. It's kind of hard to understand what the balance is that Lampard's trying to find there. So yeah, I kind of agree with Coxie that, you know, the Jorginho Gilmore type on paper definitely seems like one that holds the key to the puzzle a little bit. But then the waters are kind of murkier further when you think about Kai Havertz, and he is predominantly played in kind of one of the midfield slots for Chelsea so far this season. Isn't really a winger, can't really fit him in on the wing if you've got Pulisic and Ziyech on the other side. So it feels like a bit of a house of cards, which A, hasn't really been set up right to begin with, and B, can quite easily fall down if you're not getting the right pieces in the right places from this point onwards.
I just want to pick your brains a bit further on Havertz, because I know that you've been back and looked at his time with Leverkusen, where he played in a number of different positions and he did a number of different things for that Leverkusen side, at times almost their primary goal scorer, but also at times a creator. I mean, do you have any indication or any thoughts on where he might fit into this Chelsea team or in an ideal situation in the future? Because at the moment, among the fan base, you can imagine there's quite a lot of head scratching at this £70 million signing that doesn't appear to have a natural place in this team.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess there's going to be a piece that Liam Toomey is writing at the moment, essentially on Havertz, which will be really interesting to read on kind of his thoughts there. But it does feel that, you know, Havertz's value, the reason he was brought to Chelsea was because of the impact he had at Leverkusen, where he played predominantly as an attacking mid that drifted in from the left, or even at times as a striker as well. And Leverkusen, a bit like Leipzig with Timo Werner, were predicated on a really high, energetic pressing game. They moved from back to front really quickly. They've relied on speed on the wings with Karim Bellarabi, Leon Bailey, Moussa Diaby. And it's just a totally different environment that Havertz finds himself in at Chelsea now. I remember Liam did a great piece about Kai as well at Leverkusen and his value kind of in the air. And it just doesn't feel at all like his ability as an attacking mid to attack the ball in the air is getting used at all in this Chelsea system. So, yeah, it's, again, Werner is a player who excelled in a transition-based team and attacked at speed. Havertz is a player who excelled in a high-pressing team who attacked at speed and transition. And they've come to a Chelsea team that isn't really doing that well at all.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
I think just looking at other areas of the team, you've touched on the goalkeeper, Mendy, who had a fabulous first few weeks and less so in the last few weeks. I guess we kind of wait to see where his base level will settle. The defence you both seem fairly happy with, to be honest, both as a unit and as the individual players. The midfield we've mentioned here, just not quite the right balance. Disorganised pressing not helping in many individual matches. What about the final third? Because I suppose in this 4-3-3, you're also looking for balance in your front three. And I think it's fair to say that it hasn't necessarily been found, although there have been flashes of brilliance this season. Michael, should we start with the number nine conundrum? Giroud or not Giroud, as you guys have sort of discussed in your piece. What do you make of how Lampard has approached selecting his central striker this season?
Yeah, it's been funny. They've got three options, haven't they? They've got Giroud, who's the pure target man. They've got Werner, who purely about speed, I would say. And then they've got Tammy Abraham, who's somewhere in between. I really like Giroud. I've always liked Giroud. I think he brings players into the game better than anyone around, better than anyone in the Premier League. And I think Chelsea do have players who want that kind of forward. I think one of them is Werner. He wants to run off a striker who's occupying defenders, maybe creating space for him. I think Pulisic is another who wants to play 1-2s. I do understand why Giroud didn't start the weekend against Manchester City, because I think they, you know, you want someone who's going in behind the defence. But Chelsea didn't really offer any of that, really. They didn't offer anything from Werner with his runs in behind. So I think it's a difficult situation for Lampard. I'm not sure that there's an obvious solution for every week. I think he is going to have to pick things tactically. But just in recent weeks, I'm not completely sure he's got those decisions right. And obviously, the longer that goes on with such a talented attacking section of the side, the more people will start to ask questions.
It feels like much of Chelsea's best attacking work this season has been excelling down the sides. Now, whether that was a few games in which Reece James and Hakim Ziyech were really dovetailing nicely and offering such a threat, specifically from crosses, whether it's Pulisic and Chilwell, who have a slightly different vibe down the left, but who you could see growing into a really good combination. I mean, is it as simple as saying that, as many of the fan base were after about half an hour of seeing Werner through the middle on the weekend, that you really... It just everything points to having Giroud or Abraham up top, because, you know, Giroud is the archetypal target man and plays very well with his back to goal. But I feel like Abraham's potentially a little underrated in that sense as well.
Yeah, I'm kind of intrigued that there's been no mention of playing Giroud or Abraham in kind of the Yusuf Poulsen role that Werner kind of doubled up with at Leipzig. Leipzig, you know, usually played a 4-2-2-2. The two front men would usually be a kind of small, nimble forward in Werner and a more physical presence in Poulsen, who essentially just disrupted, made a nuisance of himself and allowed Werner to kind of use his speed to profit from that. So I'm kind of surprised we've not seen that at least trialled at some point. But then again, you know, we're at the point of Lampard's reign where you probably can't get away with experimenting too much. Otherwise, that maybe is sending the wrong signals. But yeah, like you're saying, Ali, I definitely think there's potentially something on the numbers where we'll see a bit of a resurgence from maybe Pulisic in the coming weeks. I think whenever I watch him, he's always really bright, really, really positive, trying to go forwards. Maybe decision-making isn't the best at times and tries an extra take on or dribble when he should maybe lift his head and look for the pass. But, I mean, he's got one goal for the season. I think his XG is close to 3 and he's got no assists, and the quality of chances point to him maybe, if you know, having one assist to his name so far this season. So I do think that in the coming weeks, if he can stay fit, he's got hamstrings made out of chocolate, it seems, that he will be able to kind of add a lot more value down the left for Chelsea.
And I mean, we're kind of realizing as we speak, I think, that the sheer volume of players that Lampard has to use can both be a help and a hindrance, because Michael, Hudson-Odoi has been very bright in recent substitute spells. Is that someone that you'd like to see more of?
Yeah, I must be honest. Until this season, I wasn't a huge Hudson-Odoi fan. I just wasn't convinced by his efficiency in the final third, albeit that is something that tends to come with a bit of experience and, you know, after two or three seasons as a Premier League player. But yeah, I mean, he was very bright against Arsenal as a substitute. He scored at the weekend as a substitute. And I think it was a little bit of a surprise he didn't start at the weekend, because Ziyech was returning from injury. He's been very good, as I say, usually when he's combining with Reece James. And I thought maybe with Azpilicueta there, probably wasn't going to offer a lot going forward. Maybe you would just want the speed of Hudson-Odoi against a Manchester City side playing higher up the pitch and with a left-back in Zinchenko, who is not the best defender. So yeah, I was a bit surprised he didn't start. But I think Lampard has tended to reward good performances. You know, he did that with Giroud. When Giroud came into the side, scored 4 in the Champions League, he then started a couple of games and got a run. So I think Hudson-Odoi might well get a run in the side. But again, it's about how Lampard, you know, uses his players around that. If he's playing a 4-3-3 and Hudson-Odoi is on the right, that means that presumably Pulisic and Werner would be on the left, because Werner hasn't played well up front. So then you've got 2 doesn't go into 1. Who do you pick between those two? Like you say, they've got a lot of players there, and that's without considering Kai Havertz, who, you know, as we said before, I think is probably the biggest question mark of them all at the moment.
We've kind of discussed how, given the potential strengths of the team and in wide delivery especially, that Giroud and Abraham seem probably more of a natural fit than a Werner as a number 9. Michael, what have you made of him playing off the left? Obviously, Pulisic was injured for a while, so he didn't have a huge amount of competition there. But as you've just said yourself, if you want to see more of Hudson-Odoi and maybe of Pulisic, that means seeing less of players who have played a lot of minutes. And Werner's played the second most Premier League minutes behind Conte. This is a pretty tough spell for him right now, isn't it? 12 without a goal. And if what you guys are saying is what I think you're saying, maybe not an obvious place for him in this Chelsea team right now.
I think in terms of position, there is a big question mark. I wouldn't disagree at all with what Tom said earlier about his best position. It's not really about the formation for me. It's just about the zones he's getting into. He likes being in the inside left position. He likes playing off a bigger striker. Whether you do that from a 4-3-3 or 4-2-3-1, whether it's from a number 10 position or from the left, I think you've got to get him into those zones. I wouldn't be too harsh on him in terms of his performances so far. I think, Tom has come up with some numbers that shows the XG is very good for him. What hasn't been there is the finishing. But then, as I say earlier, he's hit the woodwork five times. So he's really not far away from turning a pretty mediocre goal return into a good one. And I would say of all the Chelsea players, he's the one that really has to start because he's the one I'm most convinced will come good. You look at his record in the Bundesliga, 28 goals last season. He was absolutely sensational. I think he will eventually come good for Chelsea. I think there might need to be a system change to 4-2-3-1 to see the best of him. But yeah, of all the players Chelsea have, I would be more inclined to build the team around Werner than anyone else, to be honest.
Yeah, the stat that Michael mentioned there, I mean, we mentioned it recently on the podcast that Werner's XG per 90 was level with Harry Kane's, and it's just that one had taken the chances and the other hadn't. And yeah, that's very much still the case. Werner's had chances worth 6 XG, he scored 4. And it does feel like if a couple more of those went in, the whole narrative of Lampard and bad performances and everything kind of disappears because a couple of draws becoming wins or losses becoming draws suddenly changes the outlook on the whole league and the whole situation, really. But yeah, I mean, looking at Werner's XG, definitely is more well-suited to the left than up front in this Chelsea system. My only worry at the moment is, and it's something which we failed to mention last time, is of course there's more to being an attacking player on this left for Chelsea than just scoring goals, getting into goal scoring positions. And I use some data from Smarter Scout in the piece to kind of highlight the fact that Werner's ball retention has actually been really, really bad for a player who's involved in linking the play and getting on the ball quite a lot, but actually turning it over quite a lot as well. And I do think that if you change a system to a 4-2-3-1 or something which you can get more help around him, or at least only use him as that kind of the finisher of a move instead of involved more in the build-up, you can kind of mitigate that risk of him being quite turnover prone, make sure that his role isn't in the build-up, give that to someone else, and make sure Werner is the guy making the runs and getting on the end of balls in the box. I think that's where you'll get most of the value out of Werner and hopefully change the perception that so far he's been not a great signing.
Okay, I think we've bounced around a fair bit, looked at a lot of individual players and the setup of the team in general. Let's try and tie things together towards the end here and focus on Lampard himself as Chelsea manager, as a manager. Michael, he's 18 months into his spell in charge at Stamford Bridge. And I wonder if you could attempt to explain or describe his general tactics or principles when managing Chelsea.
Yeah, I'm not sure he has a specific philosophy. I think broadly he wants what most managers want in the modern era, which is possession football and to press aggressively when possible. But that's quite standard these days. I think he's shown tactical ability at some times. We covered on this pod, I think roughly this time last year with Liam. He's made some good decisions for big games. I think his back five against Mourinho's Spurs last year was very effective. That was a really big win for him against his former boss, obviously. I think it's tough to see an overall plan. But at Chelsea, it's generally not about philosophy. It's about getting the job done. It's about winning games. And it's generally about star players, I would say. I think Chelsea, it's a culture that, they make lots of expensive signings and they want the best from those individuals. And it's not always about a really cohesive team. So I don't think that the complete absence of a specific philosophy has to be a barrier to success. But yeah, there are some question marks in terms of, I'd say in particular, the organisation without the ball in big games.
I kind of would back up Michael's point that, Lampard's team's, it's tough to pinpoint a specific style on them. I mean, when you're looking at the stats, there's not really any metrics in particular that they are top of. I mean, they're largely average this year, at least in PPDA and various other pressing metrics, which I think we've touched on the pod before about how there's been a big drop off in Europe in the levels of pressing. But that's definitely the case for Chelsea this year. They are far less aggressive than they have been previously. They do like to have the ball a lot, and obviously they're one of the sides which average quite a lot of possession in matches. They average quite a lot of sequences with 10 or more passes as well. So it's not just, there is kind of a quite a focused approach to build up, but I wouldn't say it is it identifies Chelsea quite like Pep and his kind of approach to building up does with City. So yeah, I'm definitely just intrigued the fact that it's similar to maybe Solskjaer, but maybe less pragmatic, that again, this is just a manager who's fairly young in his managerial career, really. Hasn't really had time to fully found, a system that he likes a lot or suits him. And that, again, with Arteta, we've seen Arsenal change styles a little bit. This year, obviously, crossing is the thing that's in vogue. Maybe this is just a case of him being a young manager, still working things out, still finding what works and what doesn't. And that, you know, identity for managers comes through experience and time of the job more than anything.
One of the things he often talks about in press conferences is moving the ball quickly. And I always find that interesting because certainly on frequent occasions this season, that has not been the case on the pitch. That has not married up with watching Chelsea. And that clearly frustrates him. And you have to sort of wonder how much of that should be down to him anyway. Michael, looking forward now, they've got Fulham away and Leicester away next up in the Premier League. Followed by Wolves and Burnley back-to-back home games. To arrest this poor run of form that we discussed at the top of the show, what are the key things that need to happen to improve results?
Well, I would say very simply, I think they need, first and foremost, they need to be better at finishing. They need to be more efficient in the box. And I think Mendy needs to improve a little bit as well. And like I say, if they're finishing and their goalkeeping was at normal levels, I think they'd be a top four side. There are other issues, I think particularly the structure of the midfield, but I don't think they're that far away from being at a pretty acceptable level.
And Tom, that's interesting, isn't it? Because better in both boxes, tell me if I'm wrong here, it feels like from an underlying data perspective, that's the sort of conclusion that makes it quite hard to pin this entirely on the manager. It feels like when it comes to finishing, and we're not just talking about Werner, but the team as a whole, and when it comes to saving shots, where we are basically just talking about Mendy, I mean, there's not a ton that Lampard can do about that, is there?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. Just, you know, what are the factors that Lampard and Chelsea can control? And I do think, yeah, you're right on the attacking end. It feels with Werner, if he's so clinical in seasons past in the Bundesliga, then surely that's something that, you know, would translate to the Premier League. He's still getting a decent number of quality chances per game, which to me says that, you know, that element of his game is translated well, and the finishing will come in time. On the flip side, it is interesting that you look at kind of the XG of the chances that Chelsea concede and the post-shot XG. So that's, again, kind of where in the goal mouth that shots are, or even if they're on target, is higher. So I wonder if there's an element of, there's a minimal impact in terms of the centre-backs, the defenders, in terms of suppressing shots, making them difficult to, you know, get on target or making the angles narrow enough. There was a good example of the weekend against City where I think both Zouma and Thiago Silva were so aggressive in charging out and trying to chase the ball down that it led to Phil Foden with acres of space to kind of tap home in the box. And I do wonder if that is a recurring theme, such that there is an impact of the defenders on actually not making Mendy's life easier, and whether anything to do with Mendy's performance is just systemically down to how Chelsea have been defending at the back. But I think that's one that we need a bit more data on before really saying that that's what's happening regularly.
Well, there might not be much longer to build data on Lampard under Chelsea. If Simon and Liam's report was accurate from the other day, there's obviously been a lot of reaction to reports of the Chelsea hierarchy starting to plan for alternatives. And one thing that has sprung up a fair few times from those defending Frank Lampard who want him to stay as manager at Chelsea, one sort of regular response is that it took Jurgen Klopp 3 years to get Liverpool to even close to where they are now, where they've been the best team, certainly in England, for the last 18 months, 2 years. What do you say to that, Tom?
The whole thing with Jurgen Klopp and Liverpool is definitely and obviously a reflection of the temperament of the owner, the short-termism of the Chelsea owner, and just the situations that each manager found themselves in. Now, Klopp was probably told to start with, we are a club that doesn't throw money straight away at problems. We want to promote and build internally, and this will be a long-term project. Whereas with Chelsea, it's very much Lampard's had one season. He's probably decided these are the areas we need to target and spent £250 million in the transfer market. And that is just a reflection on the strategic goals of each of these teams. So yes, it definitely is. It's difficult to compare them like with like, really. I thought Jamie Carragher hit the nail on the head on Monday Night Football this week really well and kind of said that when managers get in a slump like Lampard has recently, they have experience to get them out of it. And Klopp has years of experience managing Mainz and then Dortmund. And then obviously he has, you know, 4 or 5 years at Liverpool under his belt as well. And with Lampard, again, like I said earlier, he's still going through some of these challenges for the first time. And he doesn't have answers in his notebook of what did I do in this situation last time? Because it's sometimes this is the first time he's been dealt £250 million worth of new players and charged with finding a tactical system that fits them all in perfectly, challenges for the title in his second season in the Premier League. So yeah, I definitely agree to some extent that it's just circumstance, the fact that Klopp had more time and less pressure than Lampard has. And that's just the way that these two clubs are kind of run, really.
Yeah, I think it's a different situation from Liverpool. Liverpool had a gradual overhaul, I'd say. One or two big names or first teamers per window or per year. I think that's probably the better way to do it, to integrate them gradually. I think it's quite tough what Lampard's got to do in terms of introducing five or six new players into the side, many of whom are playing in the Premier League for the first time, especially in a season where you don't get much time on the training ground because there's so many matches. I mean, Lampard is a funny one. I was really surprised when they appointed him. I didn't really see what he did at Derby to deserve the job. He then performed better than I expected last year, so I was wary of being too critical because I think getting Chelsea into the top four was a decent job in his first campaign. Now I think Chelsea are in a bit of a dangerous situation because I don't think they've been bad enough looking at the underlying numbers for him to lose his job. But equally, I'm far from convinced that he is the manager to take them forward in the long term. And I think there is a slight danger that they will stick with him and they could waste time really with a talented squad. So for me, it's very difficult to predict what Abramovich is going to do. But I don't really understand why he would appoint Lampard as a completely inexperienced manager and expect an immediate solution or an immediate kind of title challenge. I think if you're going to go for a long-term plan, you've probably got to stick with him in the long run. But as I say, the decision-making isn't always logical at Chelsea, and it's certainly not transparent. So I really don't know what to think about his long-term future.
Wow, so many different parts of this to break down. And thank you guys so much for doing so. It's certainly given me a lot of food for thought the last few days in terms of the Chelsea media narrative. It's been very loud, but I think the way that you guys have picked through this, I think it's been really, really interesting. And thank you very much for giving us your thoughts. I mean, you guys are outsiders, but of course we've got Simon Johnson and Liam Toomey covering Chelsea for The Athletic. They will be covering this story in every minute detail, both on site, but also on the Straight Outta Cobham podcast, which covers Chelsea weekly. It's an Athletic podcast, just like this one, and there are so many other good Athletic pods as well. So it's not just written content that you can get, but also these podcasts advert free on the Athletic site and app. If you become a subscriber today, you can go to theathletic.com/zonalmarking to pick up a deal of £3.99 a month for an annual subscription. But just left for me to say thanks for choosing us today and happy new year. Thank you to Michael and to Tom for joining me on this podcast as ever. Please do get in touch with us individually or as a three on Twitter. We're always after suggestions for future episodes. You guys know us pretty well by now. You know the sorts of things that we do, and it's really great when we get sent in suggestions from you. So please don't hesitate to get in touch with us there. Please make sure you're subscribed to this podcast feed as well, so you can join us next week on the Zonal Marking podcast, brought to you by The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.